Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Trademark Podcast. My name's Sean Byers and I'm joined by two guests today. We have Steve Baker, who's a lecturer in film and TV studies at Ulster University. He's a good friend of Trademark's, a regular guest on the podcast, and someone who's written a lot of brilliant stuff about culture and political economy of post-conflict Northern Ireland. We're also joined by Claire Mitchell, who's a writer, former sociologist. Is that right, Claire?
Yep.
And at Queen's, and I have to say, like, one of the best thinkers we have on issues of culture and identity here. So it's been an eventful few weeks here in the north, and this has produced plenty of pretty awful hot takes in the British and Irish media. So we brought Steve and Claire on to give maybe a more thoughtful and critical perspective on the crisis of unionism. But we're also going to look at Protestant politics and culture and identity in all of its diversity, and hopefully finish on a more positive sort of note. So I just want to start briefly, Steve, with the crisis facing the DUP. Now, the overwhelming majority of elected reps, you know, signed a letter calling for Foster's resignation, and she had to go. And I was actually surprised by the strength of the opposition to Foster. But when you look at the series of catastrophes that marked her tenure since 2015 and the sort of electoral picture that's emerged, this kind of change was probably coming. It was inevitable, wasn't it?
It looks inevitable now, doesn't it? I mean, Brexit has been a bit of a disaster, and that always looked very, very difficult to recover. Because they, you know, I suppose in some respects, you know, backing Brexit so vocally as they did looks like a strategic mistake. And then they made a series of blunders as well in the relationship with the Conservative government, where they clearly overplayed their hand and thought they had more power and influence than they really did. They backed Boris Johnson, who was, you know, is clearly, he's a liar, you know, and why they couldn't see that when it seemed obvious to everybody else is a bit of a mystery. And then you've also got Arlene Foster. Of course, you know, I'm surprised to learn this now, but I think she was seen as a moderate within the DUP. She was seen as a pragmatist in many ways. And her position on something like gay conversion, where I think she abstained on that vote, was just too much for certain sections of the DUP, and they consider her too socially liberal. And they've moved against her, which I think... you know, coming on the back also of a history of scandals under her, like the RHI scandal and that, you know, it's just an accumulation of things. And she looked a poor and weak leader in that context. And, you know, it does now beg a question about what the direction of the DUP is going to be in the future.
Yeah, I've been trying to make sense of the DUP's trajectory over the past number of years and the dynamics within the party. I mean, under Peter Robinson, the party looked like becoming like a broader church, or much more so than it had been in the past. And you could only see one sort of direction for it in terms of evolving into the catch-all dominant unionist party. And I suppose, as you say, Steve, like Foster was seen as continuing that project. She was seen as the continuity candidate. Now, people are saying that what we're maybe looking at now, Claire, is a return to the party's Paisleyite roots, to hardline ethnic politics and religious fundamentalism. So I just wanted to ask you, to what extent was the potential for like a modernization within the DUP, overblown? for audience help. And what role does religion play in all this, do you think?
Well, I think the DUP are pretty out of step with their electorate at the minute, and it has been kind of branded as a shift to the right. you know, with the Puts challenge and so on. But like I grew up in the church and faith, so I still have a lot of friends, and I got everybody to text their mums and dads over the last few days just to, that would be conservative evangelical still, just to see what they made of the change. And we had one Free Presbyterian mummy who was Team Puts, but all of the rest of them felt that Puts was a step too far to the right, and they would be DEP voters, consistent voters or DEP dabblers. So I find that quite interesting, because I think the personnel in the DEP, whilst there's some very, very traditional evangelicals in there, it doesn't even match up with kind of moderate and conservative evangelicals in the real world. I think Puts is too fundamentalist, the team he suggested anyway, even for them. And I think, like, even conservative evangelicals, they do love their neighbours, and they can see that we are in like a volatile political moment, and they think that Donaldson would be a safer pair of hands. And I think that he's perfectly conservative enough, to be quite frank, for them. Did anybody else get a whiff of misogyny about Arlene's ousting?
Yeah, you always get a sense of that in the mix somewhere. You know, it's I think both her and Michelle O'Neill have had a lot of that directed at them. You know, and it does, even just the optics of it, it does look like the men, you know, moving against her. I mean, I think the other thing too about it is, in terms of the DUP's return to a kind of fundamentalist roots again, I think this whole period, and I'm going to talk about this period, I think that the period of power sharing, but in particular the latter stages that we've been through of power sharing, have been very, very uncomfortable for the DUP. I don't think the DUP have enjoyed the scrutiny that has come with being in government. And you can sort of see the scandals that they get caught up in, you know, before the last time the assembly was collapsed. So I think they felt compromised in some respects by that. They didn't enjoy government. I think they're more naturally probably a party of principle and protest. And then in government just didn't really have the wherewithal in some ways to deal with that. And I think in some ways that becomes a way of explaining why the DUP were so vociferous in their backing for Brexit, when just about everybody else could sort of go, could sort of see that it was probably a mistake for unionism. But, you know, the DUP's position on Brexit, I think, was an attempt to recover a kind of pristine version of unionism, which had been compromised by participation and power sharing. You know, the DUP struggled with the kind of moral equivalences, I think, and the compromises that come with power sharing with people who were, you know, your erstwhile enemies in a sense. And so Brexit was an opportunity, or seemed like an opportunity, to kind of reset politics here, to bring it back to the old kind of reassuring animosities, you know, of divisions between, you know, the British and the Irish, between unionists and nationalists, and an opportunity to kind of reassert fundamentals rather than the kind of slippery ambiguity that there had been around the kind of language of peacemaking. And Brexit seemed to offer that kind of an opportunity. And I wonder to what extent was Arlene Foster a politician who was sufficiently moderate and sufficiently pragmatic to always be a little bit uncomfortable with the positions that she was being put in her position as a leader of the DUP. Because a leader, you know, a leader doesn't always get their own way. Of course, a leader has to be representative of something else. And I wonder to what extent she was always uncomfortable with that. And I wonder to what extent have the party been uncomfortable with the kind of compromises that they've had to make in recent times. And this leadership contest is an opportunity for them to perhaps reassert what they see as their own kind of fundamental principles again. And it might be, as you suggest, you know, Sean, a return to a party which is much more recognisable as the kind of party that PSD started. But as Claire says, I think that'll be really out of step with the people who vote for the DUP. You know,
and yeah, it's
own membership.
Yeah, it seems to me that the DUP elected reps anyway have reached the wrong conclusion about the source of their problems.
Yeah.
You know, that the answer to the failures of hardline unionism is more hardline unionism. And you would say that can only spell trouble for the DUP and unionism as a whole.
And there's a certain type of very, very conservative evangelical who would maybe describe themselves as fundamentalist. And like righteous purity really is the only thing that matters. Do you know they expect to be persecuted? Because that's what the prophecy of the end times. Do you know it is like a badge of honor? It's sort of the life that they expect to live. But obviously, if you're running a modern political party, these values are incompatible. And I think, yeah, it puts leadership, they're really gonna feel the pain.
I saw that Putz has made his play for the leadership candidacy or election, and he's released his sort of manifesto, and it makes some positive noises about engaging with civic unionism and reaching out and trying to sell the unionist vision both at home and internationally. But I suppose like even the most progressive version of Putzism is maybe out of step and out of kilter with what is needed for unionism at this present time. So I just wonder, to what extent has the DUP and by extension political unionism sort of blown its opportunity to present that positive and inclusive vision for Northern Ireland, one that gives everybody a stake in the future of the state, nationalists and others?
I mean, the last time I was on the podcast, I made reference to, there being two varieties, broad varieties of unionism. And actually, there's more than two, clearly. I think one of the things that should qualify probably everything we say from here on in this podcast is the idea that when you're talking about unionism, you're not talking about something homogenous, you're talking about something which is extraordinarily diverse. And I think that in some ways goes without saying, but there is one thing that unifies unionism, which is, of course, their commitment to the union. But within that, there's a kind of consensual unionism, which can sort of see the need to forge an accommodation with Irish identities and Irish nationalism and Irish republicanism on this island. And it will think in those sorts of terms. And then there's a siege version of unionism, which can't countenance that at all, just isn't prepared to compromise. And in some respects, I think that tension is played out in the tension between a kind of pragmatic politics that perhaps Arlene Foster stood for and a kind of biblical fundamentalism, which is also at the root of some of the DUP's politics, and very often when you've taken a kicking in the political sphere, isn't there a tendency to go, well, let's get back as quickly as we can to the fundamentals, because if we get back to that, we can re-find our way again. As you sort of said, like a sort of lost tribe, we can stick to the fundamentals, we can make our way forward again because we've lost the path that we should have been on. But the problem for me in this is, can unionism do something to recover itself? Is that there are different strains of unionism, but I hear a lot of stuff about liberal unionists, moderate unionists, and progressive unionists. And I know they're there. I've heard them talk, I've listened to their ideas. I'm politically and very close to some of the things that they care about. But the thing that section of unionism has to think about, that consensual section of unionism has to think about, is that it is represented in the assembly by three political parties, all of whom are different shades of conservative. And I don't know how to account for that. And I think liberals, moderate, and progressive unionists need to think about who it is to speak or assumes to speak on their behalf.
Or do you see any sort of avenues for that consensual civic or liberal unionism at this time? I mean, you'd think that the DUP's turn to the right would open up that space for the likes of the UUP, but it seems like it's from some of their statements that they maybe intent on following the DUP down that same path.
I know the first thing that Steve Aiken released, I think, was we're still definitely opposed to an Irish Language Act and there is no future in that. And it leaves so many pro-union people so dislocated. I think there's a blockage here in that, and maybe it's stupid to take a personal analogy, but like if you're in a relationship, right, and you really love the person, or the UK, you know, go with me. You can't control everything they do. And sometimes, no matter how much love and effort you put in, sometimes people leave you. Sometimes external events happen and things change. And that's just a very scary and uncomfortable kind of place to be in. And also, I think personally, when you have a conversation that you can tell everybody is having around you, and you're really scared, and that gives you anxiety to even think about that conversation because you don't think it's going to go well for you, the thought of that conversation, and I'm obviously talking about the constitutional conversation, Irish unity, the more you put that off and you repress it and you shove it down, I just don't think that's a good kind of state of mind to be in. And obviously the actual conversation can often be less scary as well as being a complete relief. And I don't really know what unionism does, how it can resolve that without being a bit more honest with itself in the moment that we find ourselves in. Like, I don't even know that I want Irish unity at the minute. It seems like possibly a better option that we would have more of a democratic voice. But I think unionists maybe write us, like kind of lefties or others, Republicans, whoever else, off as not having an open mind and not caring about the same things that they care about, because actually I think a lot of our values would overlap. But when you're shoving away the issue, you can't ever get to have that conversation.
That question of the relationship that unionism has with the rest of Britain, I think is interesting. I think it's interesting the way Claire frames that, because this is, you know, this for me goes to the heart of the depth of unionism's problems at the moment, which in some respects are of their own making, and other things which were beyond their agency, because when the debate that's taking place at the moment is about, you know, unionism needs a new leadership, that unionists feel that their leadership has let them down, you know, and that Arlene Foster has to go, and maybe a broader section of the unionist leadership needs to be removed. And it's almost it's a debate which is being conducted on the basis that sort of unionism is a bit like a company, and if you change the management team, that somehow the product that company is trying to sell will become more attractive to the punters that they're trying to sell it to. But unionism's problem in that respect is what it's trying to sell is becoming increasingly unattractive. And there's not much, as Claire says, that unionism can do about that, or Ulster unionism can do about that. You know, so, you know, you sort of see that we're probably moving into a period of just a long constitutional debate and perhaps crisis. It could be 5, 10, 15, could be 25 years of just constitutional uncertainty with the rise of Scottish separatism and perhaps a border poll here as well. You know, so you're going to have these concepts. And what's fueling that, I think, in many ways, is not necessarily the old identity politics of blood and belonging, but is the alarm that people in Scotland and the north of Ireland, and perhaps also in Wales increasingly also, feel about the notion of being governed by English Tories for all perpetuity. You know, so there's something wrong at the heart of the British state, that it is just going to reproduce continuous English Tory rule, or that's certainly what it looks like, or that you can't change. The problem for unionists is there's very little Ulster unionists can actually do about that. You know, there's not much that they can actually do to change that. They exist here on a kind of periphery, and their numbers are so small that there's not much they can do. So the thing that they're trying to sell is becoming increasingly unattractive. And you know, that's not necessarily their fault. But it just is what it is.
And I think that is the nail, sorry to interrupt, Stephen. I think that's the nail on the head, like that we exist as part of the UK and we think we're having a conversation about demons and usins, but the whole of the UK is having that conversation, and Scotland is having it, and Wales is having it, and we're like a little fringe part of that. And it always seems strange to me that unionism, that our debate doesn't take heed of the fact that Scotland can't tolerate this anymore, and that Wales has radically shifted its ground in terms of its toleration for Tory rule from London as well. It's fascinating.
Billy Hutchison said something really interesting. He says this very often. He makes the point that when people talk about him as a unionist, he's not just a unionist in the context of Northern Ireland, that he's part of a union of people, which is there's 6 million of them. And I think in many respects, you know, Billy Hutchison's absolutely right about that. You know, this is a union of over, 60 million people. But that tells you something really interesting. It tells you that the leader of unionism, therefore, is not Arlene Foster or Poots or Donaldson or whoever comes next. The leader of unionism is the incumbent of number 10 Downing Street. It's the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. That is who the leader of unionism is. And at the moment, the leader of unionism is Boris Johnson. And I can't imagine a more unattractive leader to have at the moment than him. He's a guy who can't even go to Scotland to campaign because he's such a liability. He just wouldn't be welcome. So, you know, again, that's an example of just how, in some ways, unionism, Ulster unionism's political agency is compromised by the fact that their real leadership in London is one that they have very little control over. And so the debate about the constitutional future of this place, you know, Ulster unionists have, there's not really much that Ulster unionists can offer here to voters. The offers are going to come from London and from Dublin. And in the next 5 years, you could see Sinn Féin as the largest party in a Dublin government, you know, and that completely sidelines unionism. So that is bound to be setting alarm bells off in unionist minds. But it's something that, you know, rather than sort of treat superficially, like you can sort of say, okay, we just need to get rid of Arlene Foster and things will be better, put a new leadership in place. You have to address those deeper, more fundamental constitutional questions. And you have to address them in a way that speaks to the people who you want to persuade. And unionism hasn't done very much to persuade anybody of anything. It's not very good at doing that there, but it's going to have to learn how to negotiate. It's going to have to learn how to persuade. And it's going to have to learn to have a bit of guile and charm about it in a way that it hasn't had for 100 years.
Yeah, both of you have sort of spoken to the demographic, generational and political changes that are happening here, which have been accelerated, I suppose, by what's happening in Britain. I think you're rightly say, Steve, we could be looking at a decade of Tory rule. And internally here in the North, unionism's not only losing its political majority, but its demographic majority as well. So there's this growing category of others, as people who don't fit neatly in their binary sort of framework, people who maybe have a more fluid or complex understanding of identity and who have various different forms of politics. Steve, I'll just come to you first on this, because you've commented elsewhere that you see a lot of positives coming out of this. As you say, like, these are the people who unionism needs to engage and who are, I suppose, up for grabs in it as part of any conversation about the future.
Yeah, I mean, if unionism goes back to its fundamentals again, then it's going to be speaking to what looks like an increasingly shrinking base. The demographics in the North are clearly on the move, not just in terms of, you know, the fact that there are maybe less people who identify as Protestants, there's maybe less people who identify very clearly as British, but also, you know, we have people who've moved to the North who are, they come from elsewhere, but they've set up families here. And they're now kind of, as I put it in another podcast, that they're part of the weft and weave of this place now. You know, there are people here who are going to have a vote in the future. And I always sort of think it's really interesting because, you know, I meet young people and students kind of regularly at a professional level. And the number of occasions I come across names on the register that, you know, I can't pronounce because they're these Eastern European names. But then you get talking to these kids and they all speak in Belfast accents. You know, in what way is unionism going to make an appeal to that generation of young people? Never mind people who no longer identify as in the sort of tribal sense they did previously. And I think peace has been important here, you know, in just kind of loosening those very kind of tribal identifications that went previously, just beginning to break up that kind of sectarian paradigm. And that's to do with the fact that, you know, for all the faults that there are, I think, about the Good Friday Agreement and the institutionalisation of sectarianism, it has allowed space and room for people to talk about women's issues, about LGBT community rights, about the climate change bill, which is sort of coming forward, a range of other issues, and also the trade union bill, which is being discussed as well. Those issues have come to the fore because we're not any longer just about one story. And there are other stories there which are clearly more attractive than the one that is told either by unionism or nationalism. So there's a growing constituency of others. And that's who needs to be persuaded one way or the other. Which takes me back to the point I made previously. Unionism has never been very good at persuading people. It's never been part of its political strategy, you know?
Claire, you might have some more general thoughts about that growing category of others that's emerging here in the North. But specifically, I suppose you describe yourself as a 1798 dissenter. That is, you see yourself as part of a radical Protestant as opposed to a unionist or loyalist tradition. And I suppose that's a tradition that's always been with us for the past 100 years, but hasn't always had the space to develop or grow. I know you're working on a new book that looks at some of the modern expressions of this dissent in Protestantism. So would you mind telling us a wee bit about that and how you see the space opening up for that type of politics and cultural expression, I suppose?
I call myself other, you know, neither, nothing, no religion, neither, for loads of years, and I would have said I was Northern Irish and that whole gamut of things. But I don't know at what point in time it just came to feel a little bit sad to me to define yourself as nothing, like a negation of everything else. And that other category is growing. It's 39% at the minute, but it is starting to close in a little bit, but it is still the largest group here. But I suppose I've opted myself back out into Protestant, and like I like taking words back and changing the meanings of things. And I love the island I live on, and I love history. I love the heritage and other, just, yeah, I needed to find deeper roots. So the idea for the book really came from, I got sick, which is why I left Queens. And as I started to kind of come back to health and life, I joined the Green Party for my sins. I started an Irish language class. I started to reflect. My parents became Quakers. I started to reflect on the kind of religious upbringing I had, which was in the Charismatic Renewal Movement, which, if you don't know, is Protestants and Catholics kind of sharing their lives together, getting married, and worshiping together. Like, it was really, really profoundly anti-sectarian. The very first thing I was taught about grocery shopping from my mum was to never ever buy South African bananas, you know, and it came with Irish passports. We were singing Nelson Mandela, Free Nelson Mandela as kids. So like I realized that isn't an other nothing identity. That's actually quite a countercultural and interesting anti-sectarian Protestant identity in the North. And so I began to wonder, like, are other people thinking along the same lines too? So yeah, I just started to pose that question. Are there any dissenters still out there? What does that even look like in the 21st century? Obviously, there's some things you need to get rid of, like the pikes, maybe include a few more women's voices and so on. And yeah, I've been out walking. Steve there made me walk, how many steps? 10,000?
10,000.
10,000 steps, have not forgotten or recovered from that. I've just been walking and having conversations with friends and just trying to explore those ideas together to see if we could put meat on the bones of what like a radical kind of left Protestant identity would look like today. What I find is that there's absolutely loads of us. We just maybe haven't really had a word. Maybe radical Protestant is a word, but because I suppose of my faith upbringing, I was aware of those more like unfashionable kind of elements, you know, that were some of the most radical people I know were Christian socialists and are still in the churches. Started to find it in the language movements, started learning Irish. And that took me around to Ulster Scots, and there's lots of kind of radical potential there to be mined as well. So yeah, I'm just really excited about finding that word and refinding that tradition. I'm totally aware that dissent is a term shared by conservatives and radicals, so I'm not trying to take away anybody else's voice. I'm just trying to say this is how I grew up. We exist, loads of us exist, and we have a lot to say, I think, about politics here, and a lot to contribute to the conversation about our constitutional futures, amongst other things.
I think in many ways media representations here really matter. And I know very often, you know, the minute sort of Northern Protestants are mentioned, you know, what stands in for them is the image of a guy, you know, sort of shaven head and tattoos. And I know that really frustrates an awful lot of people within unionism and more broadly. And I made the point earlier on that when you begin to talk about this community, whatever it is, and community is probably not the right word for it, because there's no great agreement even within that. There, what you're talking about is an extraordinarily diverse bunch, you know, which make sort of shifting alliances with each other on different issues and reach out across to other kind of groups. And I think also it's that experience is a very organic one as well. I mean, Claire, you made a point on the BBC's Red Lines podcast about, you know, just, you know, it wasn't sort of something that you went out and designed for yourself, a life like this. It's kind of where you are, you know, just it kind of happens in a sense. And I think in many respects, you know, what peace has provided, and even those spaces to do this beforehand, is just the experience of living, you know, just the experience of living in in the contemporary world. You're looking for a politics which speaks to those issues that matter to you. And so when I was younger growing up, things that mattered to me were issues around class. And I didn't go looking for issues of class. They just found me. I began to understand that the class actually mattered. I remember watching things like the miners' strike unfolding when I was younger in 84 and 85, and being really, really impacted by that, because, you know, I quickly identified which side of the miners' strike I was on. I was on the side of the people who looked like me, you know, other than as opposed to sort of a Tory toffs and stuff like that. So, you know, those were the questions that I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about class. I wanted to talk about trade unions. I wanted to talk about a traditional labour politics. Unionism didn't speak to any of those things at all. You know, so it wasn't like I made a conscious decision, and I'm sure this has driven off a lot of people, make a conscious decision to leave unionism. You know, unionism just isn't where you are. And in those sorts of debates, it doesn't speak to those issues. And I think, again, that comes back to that problem that unionism has with the people that it assumes is its own natural constituency. It increasingly isn't where they are. And if it doesn't get there, you know, it's very hard to see how it will make any convincing arguments in the future for the union.
Yeah, as you say, Steve, that laborist tradition, I suppose, within the so-called Protestant community, you know, it exists in all aspects of life. You know, it's in the trade union movement, it's in the culture and the arts, it's just a grassroots civil society, which just doesn't have a political expression. As you say, you know, what would you put that down to? Is it just the history and the trajectory, political trajectory of this place, the political framework? Is it the absence of the right party? Or because I'm sure there are a lot of radical Protestant laborists, I suppose, who would say that they don't have a party that speaks for them.
This is the thing. I think in some ways, you know, it does have a political expression. You know, it goes somewhere, but it doesn't. It isn't unionist any longer. You know, it's much more free thinking than that. So you'll find it in the Greens. You'll find it in the Labour and trade union movement. You'll find it in maybe a variety of different parties. You might even find it in Sinn Féin, you know. You'll maybe find Protestant members of Sinn Féin. So it does have it will find a political expression, but it just isn't unionism. I think I think it's a mistake to kind of look always for a unionism which is sufficiently radical to corral people back within the unionist fold who have clearly just gone elsewhere. You know, for to express themselves politically.
Yeah, I suppose what I meant really was that the absence of a Labour Party as such, you know, a coherent Labour Party that has an organic link to the trade union movement. You know, we don't have that in the north or on the island at all. But as you say, you know, I hadn't thought about it that way, that politics finds a place in other parties and in other institutions of the left. Talking about working class Protestantism, I thought we would touch briefly. I suppose we've talked about the P and the UL, or the P and the U of the PUL. I thought we'd talk a wee bit about loyalism. You know, we've seen evidence of discontent in terms of rhetoric, ongoing protests, low-scale violence, and demands, I suppose, for more hardline approaches on certain issues. And you're seeing people comment, as we often do, on the leadership vacuum that exists within loyalist communities, and people lamenting the loss of people like David Irvine and Gary McMichael and others who were so important in the early stages of the peace process. But I want to start on a more positive note, I suppose, Claire. What hasn't been reported much about amidst the violence and the protests are new grassroots initiatives. So there's one, the Her Loyal Voice, which is an attempt to give a platform to loyalist women to comment and influence issues of the day. And another that's just emerged, Let's Talk Loyalism. It's another attempt to promote a grassroots discussion and engagement on the issues facing loyalist communities. Now, I have some thoughts on these myself, like, but I suppose in the first instance, you have to see them as positive steps, like in terms of like, you want people to engage and discuss the issues, and the people who feel that they are marginalized to have a platform to voice their concerns and their issues. How do you see these initiatives? They're positive in one sense, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, like I did do a good bit of work with the Red Hand Commando and the UVF back in the early 2000s, worked closely with Billy Mitchell, who was working out of Southeast Antrim, which is known for different things now. And I really did see that kind of grassroots community action, social justice. He was a great Christian socialist, and saw that in action. And it's always given me kind of a hope and belief that there are cross-cutting issues that people from all spectrums, certainly around social class and economics and stuff, that will share those platforms in common. That project kind of went tits up. And ultimately, whenever you're working within a military sphere, all those projects are ultimately limited. There's not very much further you can go sometimes. And I think about all the brilliant loyalist women over the years, like Dawn and Sophie and Izzy, who were all kind of lundied out, and the potential that they could have brought, and the way that they really speak to the issues that properly matter to people on the ground, like self-image and self-harm and prescription drugs and mental health, you know, the whole kind of gamut, all of that stuff is really real. And so when you see that today kind of incarnated in Her Loyal Voice and all of that stuff, I mean, I read the interviews all the time. I really support the project. I love what they're doing. Sometimes I get sad because it the imaginative possibilities, after outlining all the kind of social and economic and cultural stuff we agree on, the imaginative possibilities of how we take that forward, I can't kind of find where that is yet. But maybe you don't need that to start with, because I think like the women's sector in Northern Ireland has always been really, really good at finding ways to work together on things that actually matter to our lives. And I think that as kind of left wing people, we can work around women's reproductive rights. We can work on the transfer test. There's austerity and all of these types of things. And maybe that's where we can hold that relationship for now. I was really pleased when, you know, Alison Morris and Amanda Ferguson and all set up their Women in Media thing. The one of the first panelists they had was Stacey Graham. And, you know, like, we wouldn't have the same politics, but I was really happy to see that inclusion from the very beginning. And I don't think that, I think there has to be a conversation. We might not really enjoy having that conversation, but I don't really see any alternatives, because writing is the language of the voiceless, isn't it? So no matter if contemporary loyalism isn't going in directions that we can find hope or in or relate to, the conversation just has to keep going, because they exist, we exist.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. And I think it's a good thing. I mean, I read the Her Royal Voice blog regularly. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's good because, you know, talking and writing are not separate from thinking. They're part of the thinking process. And I think at the moment, what you can kind of see is loyalism, again, trying to find a political language and a political discourse that it can speak through and that it can begin to speak to other people too. Because I think one of the problems that unionism and loyalism have had historically is that nobody understands unionism and loyalism. I mean, the politics looks entirely anachronistic in some ways. You know, it's easy for Republicans and nationalists to be understood by an international community because they speak an international politics of nationhood and statehood, and that's comprehensible by others. Loyalism is really rather different. And if you think of sort of something like a phrase which is very prominent at the moment, Ulster is British, that seems to be palpable nonsense. Ulster clearly isn't British. It's on the, you know, it's on the island of Ireland. Three of the counties are missing even from Northern Ireland. And even if you look at the demographics, you know, loyalism is sort of, you know, hemmed into one very small part of Ireland. And so that can look incomprehensible to people. Now, loyalists know exactly what they're talking about when they say Ulster is British. What they're talking about is not necessarily a territory. It's a kind of space of the loyalist imagination, which is in some respects exclusively Protestant. It's the same sort of thing when people sort of look at loyalism and incomprehension, because it says, you know, when they sort of say to loyalists, look, the British don't want you. Why would you hang around? You know, it doesn't really matter to loyalists. I don't think it matters to them what the English or the British want, because loyalists are loyal to this ideal, you know, even if the English, as they say, have betrayed it. So it's a different sort of political imagination. It's a different political kind of language that they kind of use. And I don't think it's comprehensible to their neighbours. But what you see, I think, in things like Her Royal Voice and these other blogs, and these other initiatives, is an attempt to find a language that they can speak that will make them comprehensible. And it looks to me like the language they're going for is the language of ethnicity, you know, as an ethnic group, you know. Now, I don't know where that'll end, you know, and I don't know where that'll take loyalism and unionism, but I think it's an interesting journey to be on, and it's good to see something beginning to happen, you know, within loyalism, thinking and writing and talking beginning to happen, because that's got to be the start of anything.
Yeah, I have to admit that sometimes I mean, we, in our work and any engagements we have with loyalism, we attempt to approach it from a empathetic, class-based perspective, you know, and even reading the blogs of Our Loyal Voice and reading some of the statements that are coming out from loyalists involved in these initiatives, you find yourself nodding along and agreeing on class questions, on social issues, on their critique of the DUP, on those issues. But as you say, Steve, it's wrapped up within an ethnic sort of narrative. It's wrapped up within a narrative of grievance, of a culture war, of this view that Britishness is being systemically undermined and eroded. And those claims, I suppose, are the ones that I have greatest difficulty with. You'll not be surprised to hear. So I suppose my question for the both of you would be, because, you know, we've seen two reactions, I suppose, from people on the left and republicanism. One is at times to dismiss, and from the unionist middle class as well, to be frank, and Steve, we've written on this, is to dismiss the loyalists and loyalist communities as a lumping element that's beyond salvation. This sort of dismissive, crass attitude. And on the other hand, the other extreme, I suppose, is one that almost feeds or encourages the grievance sort of narrative. So my question for you is how does the left and how do Republicans, how would you suggest they engage with loyalists and particularly engage with these initiatives from an empathetic perspective, but one that doesn't encourage or add to that sort of grievance narrative? Any thoughts?
Do you want to go first, Claire?
It's a really hard question, isn't it? I can't think further than keeping the conversation going and focusing on the areas that you do share and have in common, because I honestly believe that just encounter and conversation and dialogue and looking people in the eye as human beings at events, hopefully not just on computers, is the way forward. And like we've seen it can be done. You've seen it in the trade union movement. The women's movement have had loads of success with just keeping showing up and doing the work. And maybe that kind of ethnic framework will soften and dissolve a little bit. Maybe it won't. I don't know. On a personal level, like I find it really important, being such a Lundy and having an Irish cultural life, you know, to make sure that I teach my kids that loyalism can be good crack, and to take them to the 12th, you know, and sometimes if it's been very violent the night before, put us off. But I want my kids to know their loyalist neighbours, and I want them to have friendships and relationships and respect. And I think that's the best that I can do and that we can do at the minute.
I think it can be very difficult to come from perhaps an Irish nationalist or Irish Republican background and listen to loyalist and unionist grievances. I think that can be hard to do for very obvious reasons. But at the same time, the grievances of working class unionists and loyalists are not imagined. The union that they are a part of and that they hold very dear looks like it's disintegrating. You know, they do live, you know, there's the issues around deprivation and poverty. Those are real. They're shared. That's a shared experience across working class communities. It's not just particular to loyalist ones, but it's real enough. So those grievances are real, you know, in a way. You know, the world that once Ulster loyalists felt that they were perhaps at the centre of is beginning to disintegrate around them. So I think at some level, you've got to take those grievances seriously. You've got to take serious the problems of educational underachievement, which again, I don't think is exclusive to working class loyalist areas, but you've got to take it seriously. You've got to take seriously also the kind of lack of cultural confidence that comes with educational underachievement and the political defensiveness that comes with that. But I think you've got to be prepared to listen. And you've got to be prepared to listen to the nuances in what loyalism and unionism is sometimes saying. So, for instance, things like her Loyal Voice blog is really interesting. It was one by somebody who was interviewed under a pseudonym, Caroline. It was just, you know, really interesting to hear in many respects, a very, very radical left politics being espoused by this young woman, but also in a framework of kind of loyalism. So be prepared to listen to those kind of nuances. But there is a responsibility here also on loyalism and unionism, I think, which is to have the courage to talk to others. Because we hear an awful lot from unionist politicians and from loyalists that nobody listens to them, that they're not being heard. And that's not true. I think for unionists and loyalists, their problem is that the people that they want to listen to them seem to be ignoring them, and the people they want to listen to them are in London and they're not paying attention. But we, their neighbours, are always listening to them, sometimes with no choice because we live beside them, but we're always attuned to what they're saying, we're always listening. And maybe it would be better if unionism and loyalism began to have a conversation with the people that it's going to share this place with, and a more meaningful conversation than the one that we've perhaps had so far, because sometimes it can feel, certainly, like the unionist leadership are just trying to talk over the top of everybody who lives here's head and get a direct link and get the ear of London. So, you know, again, I think it comes back to what Claire said. It's about just keeping those lines of communication open and be prepared to listen to each other and be prepared to listen to the nuances of the conversation, and don't assume that people are just constantly saying the same thing over and over again. I think you can see emerging voices in loyalism, and you can hear the accent change. It's not as if that unionism and loyalism, no matter what it might look like on the surface, it's not impervious to the historical moment that it finds itself in.
I have kind of a rogue idea that if we could get some peace funding and organise like relay buses from Belfast to Limerick with Blind Boy Boat Club and just have loads of cans, that there would be lots of kind of meetings of minds and relationships formed. And I think, you know, guys dealing with the same issues, do you know? And yeah, cans and bus delivery.
Yeah, and I don't know, it's the NECAP, you know, the Irish Language Rap Act. They were interviewed by Channel 4 News and they made the point, this is, look, I have more in common with the 23-year-old Joe Bloggs and the Shankle than some D4 posho, you know, from BlackRock. So I suppose those conversations are maybe already happening at among the younger generation. And I know that, you know, Trademark, we've always attempted to approach these issues from an empathetic sort of perspective and to listen. And I think what we'll do maybe in the near future is invite some of those people on to have a conversation, some of the people from her Loyal Voice and from the Let's Talk Loyalism, and some of those new emerging voices from Loyalism to give their perspective on things. Says, as I think he says, it's important to listen. I just want to finish off just with a really easy question. We're in the centenary year of the Northern States Foundation. Steve, as you said, we're looking at the prospect of constitutional change across the UK, but just in the north. Opinion polls are showing that support for reunification both sides of the border is persistent. It doesn't seem to be a fleeting sort of phenomenon. And you have that group in the middle that's open to having different conversations. So how do you see the next 5 years sort of panning out?
Before I answer that, just to sort of say, I mean, you've just asked us, you know, how do you engage with working class unionists and loyalists? But, you know, Trademark have been doing that for a long time, and you've had a wonderful example of how to do it set by your two late colleagues, Joe Law and Mel Corey. You know, so you have that expertise there. On how the constitutional thing will pan out, I've said this before, I don't think there's anything historically inevitable about what's going to happen. And it would be awful actually if there was an historical inevitability about this. Because one of the things that we want on the left is to have political agency, is to be able to make arguments, you know, that we just don't get railroaded into one constitutional settlement or another without, you know, any kind of say in what they actually look like. The other point I made earlier on was that, you know, this is going to be about persuasion. This is going to be about what offers are made by London and Dublin. And it's going to be about the quality of those offers, both in terms of the kind of participatory democracies that are offered, what kind of voice people have, but also the kind of social and economic issues that they strive to address as well. I don't think anything's inevitable. I think it's quite conceivable that, unionism wins an Indy referendum in Scotland. It's quite conceivable that unionism wins a border poll here in the near future. The thing about that is these questions don't go away. that's not the end of it, you know. Just as the 2014 referendum wasn't the end of Scotland, what matters after those border polls and independence referendums is how the winners of those respond to those who have lost them. And that's going to be crucial, because the first thing that you've got to do if you win a border poll or an independence referendum is to, you know, you'll celebrate, you know, of course, but shake the hangover off quickly and get to work at building the constitutional settlement that you want and trying to win over the people who have lost it. We've seen in the Scottish independence referendum that that's not what happened. You know, Cameron very quickly came out and sort of said, well, we've won this here, we hear you, Scotland, and then pitched immediately to English concerns. After whatever happens out of this period of constitutional uncertainty, you have to hope that whoever wins it can act with a degree of political generosity the other side of it.
Claire, do you have any final thoughts about the future in the next 5-10 years? I got a sense that you're quite optimistic about some of the conversations that are happening.
I am and I am. It depends on the day. I mean, Heather Wilson has put it really well, and she said, would you stop telling Protestants that they'll be welcome in a new Ireland, because we will be the new Ireland. And I really like the sense of taking that kind of agency back, and, you know, and not seeing the North as a place to be pitied. You know, London doesn't want us, and the South can't afford us, and poor us. And just, I love rethinking of it in terms of, look at you, Radical Hellions, and all the work that you do in your lives. Like, we have so much to offer as the North. One thing that is coming across, like, as I'm doing research for the book, I mean, harking back to 1798, it's just the call for deeper democracy. People as citizens here don't feel that they have a voice. They don't feel that we're ever going to have a chance of influencing debates in Westminster. And it leaves like the most enormous sense of powerlessness. And I think whatever constitutional future conversation we have, that absolutely has to be addressed, because you can't have citizens going around feeling so powerless. It's not going to work out well. I really hope that a civic forum is one of the first moves. That sounds maybe very middle of the road, but we've seen it with reproductive rights as well. Whenever you have just people as humans looking each other in the eye, and people aren't as scary as the ideas of the people. Do you know, people rarely are enemies in practice. You know, because the foundations of the whole conversation are different. Everything is global and digital and seas and soil. And like, what relevance are these debates? But then I think the United Irishmen probably thought that they had the answer and that they would be the last generation to have to forge this anti-sectarian alliance to deal with the new issues. So I think we just have to keep plugging away kind of our radical ideas, because the best case scenario is that climate politics and future politics kind of brings us all along into similar places. And the worst case scenario, I think, is that, you know, there's floods and demons are getting all the good sandbags.
I think, as Claire says, you know, one of the problems at the moment that within the kind of settlement that we have across these islands is that, you know, as Claire says, people don't feel like they've got a voice, and that's not sustainable. So constitutional change is coming. We all need to get busy.
Okay, thanks very much to the both of you. I think we'll keep one eye on that more optimistic, positive vision, and not the one that ends up with us all engulfed in flames. Look, I just want to thank the both of you for coming on. It's been a really interesting and enlightening discussion for me. I hope we get you both on back on at some point in the future. So thanks very much.
Cheers.
Cheers, Claire.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers, and Slán go fóill.